Finance and Revenue is open.
Shawna Civil War is ending the main Civil War.
Good morning. We're going to start off today with Chris Allenek's tax credit report. Morning, Chris.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. So in OLIS, there is the tax credit review report. This is the second such report. As you may recall, in 2013, legislation was passed that required the Legislative Revenue Office to produce this report. Last session was the first time. And we didn't get a lot of feedback on changes to the report, so the structure is largely identical to that report. You have sections 1 and 2, which kind of set up the report. They talk about tax expenditures in general, just the concept, for those who aren't familiar with the concept, and then a little bit about the process. And then the bulk of the report is in section 3, and that goes through each of the tax credits individually. They are, and within, for each tax credit, there are basically four kinds of information. There's a policy purpose discussion, a description of the provision. There's an other section for kind of miscellaneous information. Usually it's about other states that have a similar tax credit or administrative issues or anything else that doesn't kind of fit the other categories. And then there's an analysis section. And the report is organized into themes or policy areas. So the primary policy areas this time around are economic development, energy, and housing. And then we have a couple miscellaneous ones. We have a couple natural resource credits, and then there's an other category. The other category does contain the rural medical tax credit. It was a carryover from last session. As you recall, the assembly just extended that by 2 years. They did change that credit, but it was just extended by 2 years, so it's a repeat performer. So the report is rather lengthy, so I apologize for that. I didn't have time to make it shorter. But
I'll give you that opportunity later.
So I think what I really wanted to touch on were kind of themes and bottom, you know, kind of takeaways from the report and going through the information this time, because there were some very meaty policy issues here. Economic development is always contentious. Everybody's well aware of the housing issues within the state. And then energy, probably nothing needs to be said about the contention around those tax credits and that issue. So as I was going through this, some of the themes that emerged would be in terms of an ask for the legislature as the policy committees and as you debate these provisions would be, I would urge you, or the assembly, to be as clear as possible about purpose statements for every one of the tax credits. being as clear as possible about the purpose really sets the stage for future analysis. That really is the linchpin to evaluate whether or not a tax credit is doing what you want it to do. We need to know what that is. And oftentimes, it's not necessarily a moonshot to guess what that purpose is. But some issues, particularly economic development, can be very broad. Many times, economic development is a euphemism for job creation, but it doesn't have to be. So just being as clear as possible about purpose statements. Now, this round of tax credits, because they were first extended in the 2011 session, there was some legislative record about proposed policy purpose statements and so forth. So some of that information is in here. It does help provide state agencies and other stakeholders to be able to point to, well, the legislature said the policy purpose is A, B, and C. And then following on that, so that's a very high-level discussion, but following on that would be, the next thing that would be helpful would be a list of some initial metrics. So how can we measure progress toward that policy or toward that goal? Because one of the key elements in here is, when do we expect to reach that goal? Many arguments about the tax credits are, when does an incentive become a subsidy? If an incentive might be good and well to get some sort of action underway, but eventually the incentive should no longer be necessary. Or these are how some of the arguments go. So to understand how that progress is made, metrics are a key piece. And they don't have to be terribly complicated, even just a short list of initial metrics gets the conversation moving and helps everybody understand what the legislature is trying to get at with the policy and how we might be able to get there. An example of one from a couple of sessions ago, there was a bill, I think it was in the Energy Committee, and it required, and I can't remember what the policy was, but it required a lot of detailed information on jobs, direct, indirect, and induced, and kind of a full-blown economic impact analysis. And people were concerned about that information that was included in the legislation, so that would have been a statutory requirement because of the potential costs related. And some of the projects, the cost would have been larger than the benefit of some of the projects. So a solution to that I suggested then was just limiting that to just a direct jobs impact. And that's a much easier metric. It doesn't capture the full breadth of the information related to the policy, but it's a much easier number to get than a full-blown economic impact analysis, which a company would have to purchase or hire a consulting firm to do. So along the metrics, anything simple, it just helps move that conversation forward so that the state understands what it's effectively what it's buying with these tax credit dollars. Tax credit dollars are spent on any number of these policies. Well, what the first step would be, well, what is the state getting for those dollars? And a lot of these, there is a, everybody's familiar with the but-for question as another example. How do we know if a tax credit really induces a behavior that was or was not going to occur anyway? And there's a lot of effort in the literature and by researchers and stakeholders to answer that question. And it's a very difficult, if not fully elusive, question to answer. So I would urge you not to think in at that level and having that level of requirement for analysis, but just any step toward that direction would be helpful. And that's the metrics. They could be simple metrics. And within that, there is the value of data collection. So as being as clear as possible about who collects the data, the process, and again, keeping it simple just so administrative costs don't go through the roof. But any clarity around this process would be helpful as well. Because when I talk to state agencies or advocates, data is always an issue about who is responsible for collecting it and reporting it. And in many ways, the legislature has taken this step with this report as being at least one venue for that information to be collected and gathered and reported back to you. So as we keep moving with this six-year cycle, if this continues on, this is the good time to be thinking about these tax credits and what information you want to know. And that process should come up this time. Committees should be asking, okay, well, these are the things I want to know, and if we don't know them right now, what can the legislature do to ensure that the next time these tax credits come up, we've made progress on gathering that information? So those are kind of the big themes around, I think, as I was going through the credits this time. And for a lot of these, that there's a familiar theme for many of the credits. I go through and I do a literature review, literature search. And just so for folks who aren't familiar with the issue, here are the pros and cons of a given policy. This is what advocates are saying. This is what opponents are saying, just so you're familiar with all sides. And what research is doing, academic research is doing to try and answer some of these questions and how they're thinking about evaluating some of these. I think that helps inform the legislative discussion as the policymaking body. The third area and the last piece I wanted to touch on were differences in this report from the first one. It does include in section 4 of the report a section on transferability. The state currently has 6 tax credits that are transferable in one way or another. And I believe there is at least one bill this session, it might be a House bill, that puts forth the idea of having all of the transferability in one section of statute so that for the legislature, if you decide that a tax credit should be transferable, you can just point to this statute and there's clarity around how that is done. And that section does go through about the tax implications of these tax credits that are transferable. As the legislature moves forward with that discussion, I'm not sure that every one of these tax credits fits into a same process. I think of the 6, 5 of them probably do, but one of them may not, and that's the Affordable Housing Lenders Credit. The transferability there is somewhat unique. The other two pieces in this report that are different from last time. There is also a process history. At LRO, we often get asked about history, so we're trying to document this as we go along. So a section of the report contains a history of the process, so interested parties can go back basically from 2009 to 2015 and see what the legislature has done over time with the tax credits in general. That, and so for new folks, that really lays out kind of the 101 on what the legislature is doing. And then the last piece in one of the appendices is information that was required last time. It was House Bill 3542 that was really interested in understanding the estimated revenue impacts that come out of our office and how they compare to the actual impacts. So in there are a list of the tax credits that were modified or extended between 2011 and 2014, their estimated impacts, and then their actual impacts for tax year 2014. So for these 10 or 12 tax credits, we can see what LRO projected the estimated cost would be compared to the actual cost. And differences are provided there both in absolute terms and percentage terms. And if there's interest, I can delve into any more of those, but it's a long report and I didn't want to torture people one page at a time. So that's my high-level overview.
Question over there, Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Boquist.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Two questions, if you would, please, Mr. Chair. Chris, first, apologize for not giving you better input. So when we, generally speaking, when we get down to brass tacks on joint tax, just before we're all ready to, you know, go to blows with our colleagues across the aisle for multiple meetings, we generally end up producing what I would call an executive summary or a white paper that's like maybe one page or two page maximum that has the 15 tax credits, potentially, you know, not more than two sentences saying, you know, the tribal enterprise zone is XYZ. In two sentences or less, and then a sort of a block chart that is on page whatever here, Mr. Paul, but not so complex, that says it's costing us this biennium X dollars, and if we want to buy it in the next biennium, it costs us Y dollars.
Page 11,
right? But not as complex as this, much more simpler. So when we get down to, you know, tax credits 101, as you were saying, what's it cost us, so on and so forth, is, before we get to the point of having further discussions in terms of joint tax credits and all that, is it possible to prepare sort of that one pager, maximum two pager? Basically, our cheat sheet, the cliff notes for tax credit.
Yes, Chair Haas, Vice Chair Boquist, I can do that right now. All that information is here. It can be boiled down to one page, and I can share that. When we get to JTAX, that may change a little bit depending on changes that the policy committees make. So if you want that information now, I can certainly boil that down to have the cliff notes summary and share that. And it may change, just to be aware that it may change by the time we get to JTAX. And yeah, the revenue impact here, this table is provided for a higher level view. I've encountered a lot of confusion from folks who look at the tax expenditure report, which is a cost under current law, and that's kind of this piece here, versus the cost to extend the tax credits. So for example, the R&D credit, qualified research, here under current law, this is the projected cost of the tax credit over time, from $22 million last biennium down to, I think that's about $4 million in 21-23. The tax credit under current law sunsets in 2018, but there are carry-forward provisions, so there will still be a revenue impact for future years. But it declines over time, and that's the theme here. All of these will decline over time, and the cost to extend increases over time. Right now, there's a small cost in 17-19. Largely, that's a one-year piece. So generally speaking, the 17-19 estimate compared to the 19-21 estimate is going to be about half. So it's not that there is dramatic growth going from 1719 to 1921. It's that the 2019-21 biennium is a two-year estimate, and the 1719 biennium is a one-year estimate, because all of these tax credits sunset in the middle of the 1719 biennium. So that's another source. I get that question sometimes, but well, you know, this tax credit is exploding in use.
My second question, Mr. Chair.
Sure.
So in short, but summary, looking at your chart, if we do absolutely nothing, all 15 tax credits go away and there's $32 million in additional revenue, correct?
Conceptually, the additional revenue, I would pick on that particular language because the sunset's a part of current law. And so that $32 million is already in the current law revenue forecast. So it depends on what you mean by additional.
So if we wanted to re-up these credits, it would be like we're adding $32 million to the Ways and Means expenditure list.
Correct. It's spending the money through the tax system.
Right, Mr. Chairman. My point was just if we do absolutely nothing, they go away.
Which is correct.
Yeah. Senator Taylor.
Thank you, Chair Hass. Can you just maybe summarize briefly I'm dying to know what the difference was between you had the analysis by LRO and what it actually ended up being. What was the general difference? Was it pretty accurate, or maybe we can just have it later, get it later?
Well, I can pull it up. Accurate is in the eye of the beholder.
Okay. Which page is it?
It is Appendix E on page 139.
Okay.
And I can kind of see if I can blow up the table here.
Right.
So who was off 9%?
So.
Very small print.
Okay, so the tax credits. Okay, so I think on the screen it might be a little easier to read. So let me take a minute to explain some of this.
Okay.
So we have the estimates. This is the year of the estimate. Most of them were 2013. That was from the tax credit review process. There is one in 2011 and one in 2014. So that's when the estimates were made. And the estimates take two parts. There's a base and a change. Mm-hmm. And the base is what, if there's no change to anything, the sunset is allowed to hold and there are carry forwards, that there will be an impact on current law. So for example, the Affordable Housing Lenders Credit, so I'm looking at this in 2011, mm-hmm. and the bill there just extended it 6 years. But it's a 20-year credit. It follows the loan. Okay. So there's going to be a revenue impact for 20 years.
Okay.
So back in 2011, with the information that we had available, we were thinking, okay, it's going to cost $10 million in 2014. The bill to extend the sunset, I didn't think it would have any revenue impact in 2014. The revenue impact didn't really start until 2015. So that's why change is zero. So back in 2011, the estimated impact for this tax credit in tax year 2014 was $10 million. So now we've gotten to the point where we have actual information from tax returns, and the cost was actually $7.6 million.
Follows, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Because people didn't claim it?
Right. Basically, the baseline forecast was too high for the cost of the credit.
But it's due to people not claiming it.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah. It could be a lot of factors, but the bottom line, yeah, they didn't claim as much as we thought. And so that error, so there are two potential sources of error for these estimates. They have the baseline scenario and then the change. So if we look at, for example, the earned income tax credit, which is a refundable credit, there's no carry forward. It was scheduled to sunset on 1/1/14. So the impact in 2014 was going to be zero. It was going away. So nobody, we're sitting here during the 2013 session and thinking the EIC goes away, so there's no impact in 2014. The estimated impact was $54 million. So if we got, there are another footnotes that you can see on the table. But if that were extended, it was going to cost $54 million. In reality, it cost $48 million. So it was $6 million short on cost. So the error there, in percentage term, was about 11%.
Okay. Follow-up, Chair?
Senator Taylor.
Thank you. So how does that then tie in when we're building off what Senator Boquist was just talking about? So this $32 million, and you have things like this living out there on different paths, which I think, complicates the tax credit conversation, right? So how would these changes that are occurring here tie into the, when Senator Boquist referred to the $32 million, that if nothing happened, they would go away? How does this tie into that?
That the $32 million would be the sum of this change column.
It's the sum of the change column. Okay. Thank you.
The first column will be all zeros because by law they're going to go away.
Yeah, just clarifying.
On page 7, the tax expenditure levels, you've got almost a hockey stick increase in deductions. And, you know, I won't say we've got a handle on tax credits yet, but I think we're at least on it. But we don't, we certainly haven't established a process similar to tax credits on deductions and subtractions. And they are, you know, obviously, according to that chart, that's
an increase,
you know, alarming, maybe. Mm-hmm. And so I was just wondering what your thoughts are on, you know, trying to wrangle that one into at least to, you know, manage it.
That, as the legislature has established this tax credit, it all started with all tax expenditures. If I could back up a minute just from history and some context. And everybody's familiar with the tax expenditure report, which is very large. And even on the income tax side, it's very large. So in terms of trying to make progress on the issue, tax credits were the focus because those are Oregon-only policies, and they're the closest that mimic direct spending. But the deductions and subtractions are kind of the next step. So there are two pieces here. We get Oregon subtractions, which are ways that Oregon deviates from federal taxable income. And then we have all of the federal deductions, which are largely Schedule A deductions. So a couple of the drivers here, I'd have to give a full answer, I'd have to refresh my memory on the drivers behind the change, but a couple that come to mind are expecting that the home mortgage interest deduction was going to start increasing again. A lot of this leveling and falling here was we saw the HMI falling off. It was just a hangover from the housing collapse. That year over year, those deductions were getting smaller. So that contributed to the dampening here and then actual decline here. But as we're coming out and the housing market, such as it is, starts to get back on track and people are able to get out mortgages more than in recent years, that deduction is going to increase. So that's part of the driver. Another driver here is a policy that is before the legislature this time. It was from the 2013 special session. It's the pass-through income. That's a couple hundred million dollars of that piece. So that, in terms of the Oregon-only provision, that's the main one, the pass-through, that contributed to this growth. Most of the other growth is from, I think, Schedule A, like the home mortgage and interest deduction. Other piece that falls in here is the federal tax subtraction. So that will increase as federal taxes increase. However, there is, because that subtraction is capped for Oregon, it won't have the same growth impact. That will grow as more tax filers have more federal taxable income, but that subtraction is limited to $6,000 or $6,500 right now.
What's the cost of that?
I'd have to look it up. It's a few hundred million dollars, I believe, but I can get that to you. I don't have that off the top of my head. Or actually, I spoke too soon.
You spent so little time on this, you don't remember.
Well, see, now I'm going to be fumbling through here to find it. There's a table here.
Remember when we just had paper?
Yes, I do.
Mr. Chair, do not get me started on the whole electronic thing at this point.
Okay, so page...
You're going to find out on the floor. I vote against all those bills.
Page 6.
So page 6 in the report.
Doesn't show.
So we start off with income. So this is one of the tables that I to provide more context on what we're talking about in terms of dollar impact, because folks like to look at the total cost in tax expenditures and compare that to the direct budget. So for the 17-19 biennium, so these are estimates, total income tax expenditures were $13.5 billion. That's everything. Well, the first block of that are federal exclusions. And that's $6.5 billion. And federal exclusions are items that do not show up on any tax return. They're income that the federal government says, we're not going to tax it, you don't need to report it. For example, a big piece of this is the non-taxability of medical insurance, so employer-provided medical insurance. That certainly could be taxable. It is not taxable, so it's viewed as a tax expenditure. So that's a big chunk there. And then we get into the federal deductions. And then bouncing down here to the federal tax subtraction, it's $900 million to get at your direct answer.
Right, per year?
Per, this is for the biennium.
Biennium.
But these are the large ones, the federal deductions, home property taxes, and then medical expenses. This is Schedule A. This is Schedule A, this is Schedule A, and this is Schedule A. Mortgage interest, property taxes, charitable contributions, and medical expenses. And then we get down to the organ subtractions. Social Security income, that's in the Constitution. So it can be changed. The path is just different. And then federal pension income, that was a court decision on equity treatment between federal pensions and state pensions. And then you get down to some smaller ones. And then the largest tax credit is the personal exemption tax credit, which costs $1.2 billion. Now, that is one that does not have a sunset date. There are three credits that do not have a sunset date currently. Personal exemption credit, the credit for taxes paid to another state, and the claim of right income. And the reason those don't have a sunset, the sunset was not placed on them back in 2009 when the legislature did this. And that's largely because those three credits are viewed as part of the tax base. The personal exemption credit, it's been modified over time, but it's largely viewed as some sort of minimal amount of income that is exempt from tax. It cannot, just about everybody gets it. It's been means tested since then. But it's equivalent to a 0% tax bracket in some ways. So it's kind of part of the base system. So it's not really a policy that any sort of goal or objective will be achieved. It's part of revenue policy, if you will. The taxes paid to other states is preventing a kind of double taxation among the states, basically saying, well, if that other state taxed your income, we're not going to tax it as well. And the claim of right income is a very obscure tax credit, and it is basically a mechanism for refunding taxes that had been inappropriately paid in the past. Again, another base issue. So as we sit here today, those three tax credits do not have a sunset date for those issues. Having said that, there are two tax credits in the report here that the legislature may want to consider removing the sunset dates for similar reasons.
Okay. So you want to finish that thought?
Those two tax credits are the reservation tax credit and the fire insurance tax credit.
We're going to talk about here in a minute.
Right.
Okay.
Reservation, you have the bill on Thursday.
The reservation's on Thursday. The insurance is coming up here shortly. Back to the federal tax subtraction, could you refresh our memory and how that came into play and whether it's been amended since then?
It has been around a while and it has been amended.
But it was a ballot measure, right?
There was
an initiative.
Yes, I can't recall when it first came on the books, but for the longest time, it was a $3,000 subtraction. There was a ballot measure about 15 years ago, I think, that would, it was a citizen's petition. It was going to make it, remove the cap, so all taxes would be subtracted. The legislature knew this, and the legislature referred to the ballot an opposing or a competing ballot measure that said, well, we're going to increase it to $5,000 and index it to inflation. So voters had before them these two alternative policies, an unlimited federal tax subtraction or proposed by, it was a citizens initiative, or from one from the legislature that said, well, we're going to increase it to $5,000 and then index it to inflation. And the voters went for the legislative option. And so it was increased to $5,000. Now, at the time, this is 2002, and then during many of those special sessions, it was modified again, And I think it might have delayed the implementation of it a year or two as a way to raise some revenue. And then it's been indexed to inflation since then. And so the maximum now is somewhere in the $6,500 mark. And then it was modified again in 2009, and it was capped. At one point, it was phased out. So for single filers with income between 125 and 150, and joint filers between with income between 250 and 260, it was phased out. And then it was modified again, and it was just capped. So now, unless I'm mixing up, policies now,
yeah,
aren't I?
Yeah, I think the federal subtraction was phased out as part of Measure 66 for those high-end people. So at the same time you put in the higher rates, then it's phased out for a joint filer between 250 and 290. The exemption credits where you have that absolute cap on it, between at 100 and 200.
Right, that's where I started.
Okay, so this, I think there was a Bill Sizemore measure that was...
That was the one that unlimited.
The legislature put out
Measure 88.
Measure 88, and voters chose the less extreme.
Correct.
Which is what I was hoping to do with Measure 97. A year ago.
Don't talk about the past.
Yeah. Well, I think voters are, you know, voters would have done the same thing. Still on that federal tax subtraction, I'm way out over my skis here, but given the Seattle Light decision, would changes to that be three-fifths or majority? Or
that is a good question. We've had conversations around that. Conceptually, it seems it is definitely a legislative council question. We have had conversations on one level. Conceptually, it doesn't change the rate. It's a base broadening. So that seems to suggest it doesn't require three-fifths. But then when you look at the magnitude of the impact, that's where questions really start to come in, at least in our minds, about, okay, the policy, it's a base changing, doesn't change the rates, which was what Seattle Lights got at. But with the magnitude of that size, can that really be passed without a three-fifths? So I think Ledge Council is still debating that. I don't know if Paul has anything to add to that.
Well, I just think the other one that comes to mind is the personal exemption credit, the same, exactly same analysis. It isn't a rate increase. It isn't imposing a tax. Yet, you look at the revenue, implications are huge. So that's something, you know, we would have to really sort through with Council to where they would be comfortable with. And, of course, ultimately, as we know, it's the court decision.
We will get sued ultimately. That's
yes, and something of that magnitude, I would imagine that would be the case. One of the bills that the House committee introduced and this is in discussions with counsel, would expedite a Supreme Court decision. So if you do pass a bill and the counsel says it's not a bill for raising revenue and you don't get the three-fifths, then there would be a speed-up or you get the decision. So that way you would at least minimize the potential refund costs that would come from losing a court decision.
Okay, well, we will go through this. It's a pretty rich document. And, Senator Bartschinger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chris, since we're connected with the federal tax code, Section 179 is made permanent at $500,000 for accelerated depreciation. Have you guys looked at how that is going to affect us here at the state level? Because that's non-taxable income as far as the state is.
Right, that's embedded, I think, in the business expenses here. I collapsed a few categories. Okay. I think the Section 179 is part of that. It's accelerated depreciation in Section 179.
Yeah, because for years it kind of, you never knew if it was going to be renewed or not renewed, you know, back and forth. But now it looks like it's etched in granite. So that's something we're just going to have to live with.
Yes, the issue did come up because it perennially came up because of the short sunset, just as you indicated. But now it is part of permanent law. So the discussion there goes to a more general discussion about where Oregon should be tied to federal law. I mean, it's still a policy choice to tie to federal law. Mm-hmm. And we do disconnect from certain provisions of law. So it's not an all or nothing discussion, but it gets wrapped up in that.
because we have this conversation over corporations and businesses and everything. And I mean, that's fine. I got it. I just want to know, you know, how does it affect, how does it really affect us? Mm-hmm. You know, that part I don't know.
Mr. Chair, we do have you do introduce a reconnect bill, which would deal with mostly technical issues, but also kind of the general issue. And typically we have, we'll set a time to get the CPAs to come in and go through that with you, mm-hmm. what the latest federal changes are. We're working on the schedule on that.
Good. Yeah, we got their thing the other day.
Right.
Any other questions about this report for Chris Alanek?
It's riveting.
Okay. Then let's close our informational meeting.
Everybody
and
will want their money.
I will open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 162.
Okay.
And is that Chris as well?
Yeah, we can have
moving
fun.
Up here.
Musical chairs.
Mm-hmm.
Want to be beat about the head and shoulders.
Can you give us a quick summary?
This is one of those you get beat up no matter what you do.
Okay, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 162 conceptually makes two changes, but within one of those there are kind of four parts. The first one here you see in the language in the front of it, it removes rulemaking authority from the Department of Revenue to determine which C corporation tax credits can be claimed by S corporations. So it just removes that rulemaking authority.
Why do we do that?
Yeah, why are we doing that?
That's a good question.
It
came to our attention recently that DOR had that rulemaking authority, and that seemed more of a policy issue than an administrative issue. So we had this bill drafted to bring it before the committee. But you're asking a larger question as to how they.
Well, I'm just wondering, was it replaced with something, or is it you're saying it's just going to be a policy?
So stepping back, we have all of these tax credits that can be claimed by corporations. Generally, they're C corporations, and within this statute, the legislature went through and listed credit by credit. Okay, this credit can be claimed by S corporation shareholders and so forth. There's basically a list, but within that list. The legislature granted the Department of Revenue rulemaking authority mm-hmm. to add credits to that list. And we weren't really aware of that until recently. And we had it drafted because it seems more like a policy issue for the legislature to discuss. Mm-hmm. It isn't necessarily good or bad. It does get into that issue of tax credits. Should they be limited to C corporations? Or should they be allowed to other types of business entities? And to further that point, it's not even necessarily just limiting it to S corporations. If there's a tax credit that is good for businesses, should it be available to all business structures, not just two types of structures?
Is the idea then so that the legislature is making each of the decisions instead of having it being done by the Department of Revenue? Is that the idea?
Correct. And especially with this tax credit review process, as they get reviewed, should they be allowed for one business type or all business types?
So back to the Cliff Notes. The summary of this is, do we want the executive branch to make all the decisions, or do we want the legislature to make the decisions, right?
That would be a fair summary.
Okay, got it. Mm-hmm.
Deanna Mack from the Oregon Department of Revenue.
There
are some other provisions in there. So.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, okay, yeah. All right.
All right. Good morning, members of the committee.
Good morning.
I'm Deanna Mack with Department of Revenue, and I am here to add to what the information that Chris just shared with you. We did talk to LRO about the fact that we have rulemaking authority for business tax credits under this particular bill or this particular statute 314752. And because we do have quite a few business tax credits that we have adopted in rule that are allowed to individual taxpayers through the pass-through feature of the S corporations. So what we thought it was a little odd that it was there, as you apparently you do as well. It's in lines 22 through 26, and it talks about what a business tax credit is. It's a tax credit granted to personal income taxpayers to encourage certain investment to create employment, economic opportunity, or incentive, or for charitable, educational, scientific, literary, or public purposes that is listed in this subsection or is designated as a business tax credit by law or the Department of Revenue by rule. And it's not limited to the list that's in the statute. So I quickly provided, I thank you for posting that, a list of credits that are listed in statute, a list of credits that are listed in our rule, and a few more that are allowed that are not yet in our rule that fit that definition of business tax credit. So we wanted to alert you to that, that component, to make sure that you really were aware that we had that kind of rulemaking authority. It seems fairly broad for, we usually have interpretive and procedural type of rulemaking authority, where this seems a little broader than that, so we wanted to alert you to that. The bill does not address the credits that we have in rule, and so we would like you to look at that list and see if you want those credits to be continued in the statute or not. Certainly would work with you on an amendment there. Let me see. I know this bill has two components, and so I wanted to make sure I didn't miss any of that component. Yes, sir.
Senator Roquist.
I have a question on the first component before you move and confuses the second component.
Okay, no problem.
In the first component, we generally, and thank you for bringing attention, and I understand what you're saying, if in the overall picture, if we set a statute, right, then there's clear guidance, and generally speaking, it's, for a better word, less litigable. It's less options to sue it back and forth because we set the statute, and as long as it doesn't conflict with someplace else, it's the law. If in this particular case, if you guys go out and you're picking and choosing under the administrative rule, it makes it quite open to litigation and interpretation, does it not?
Mr. Chair, Senator Boquist, that has not come to fruition. The credits are obviously in the taxpayers' favor. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, they're being allowed in their favor. But they are business tax credits. I mean, that definition in the statute is very broad, and that's what we apply. They, as far as I can tell, they seem to be defensible in the what we've put in the administrative rule, and no one's challenged it.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
So far we haven't had problems in terms mm-hmm. of you decided that this type of entity should get it and this sort of entity, and the losing entity hasn't, you know, drug us into court, so to speak. Is that correct? Is that a general statement?
Mr. Chair, Senator Boquist, I believe that is correct. I mean, the entity that wouldn't get it would be the partnerships. I believe that that's the difference there, partners in a partnership.
One follow-up for both Chris and Deanna. Any guess how we got here?
Why
did we take half and decide we're going to make rules for these and we're going to not make them for these? Was it we didn't have the intestinal fortitude because we thought this might be dicey and we didn't want to make the rule? Or, I mean, how did we end up with two complete separate, frankly, policies?
Yeah.
Some of them we say we must do it. Some of them you guys get thrown the bones.
The origins, Mr. Chair and Senator Boquist, the origins of this particular statute date back to 1991, and I do believe it was a department concept trying to address some issues that we had in administering the rural medical credit that was enacted by the body in 1989. And so we asked for clarity. Jen Brown from our department testified then that was what we were hoping to gain, and the legislature chose to give us that rule writing authority and that very broad definition. You make these policy changes. I think they just want to make sure that nothing got missed, just to cover bases. Mm-hmm. But it is unusual, and that's why we brought it forward, because we started looking at the rule. Recently, the Secretary of State required us to renumber all of our rules in our entire agency, from tying to the statute to conforming with their new numbering system. And well, it's not new, actually. We're the only agency that haven't been using that system, so they made us do that. And so as part of that process, we were looking through all our rules and renumbering them and looking at rule changes for content, and we discovered this and thought, why do we have this? And then we talked to LRO about it, thinking it was a little broader than you probably intended. We can still administer it if you want us to, but we just thought it'd be worth a conversation to make sure that you really did mean to have us have that kind of authority on that particular piece of this bill.
Mr. Just one comment for
Sarah.
I can, if this came out in 1991 in regards to the rural medical tax credit, I can easily see why we threw this to the department so that we wouldn't be dealing with the political hot potato. I'm not sure it's a good policy. I can just, having been involved in that particular tax credit, I can easily see how this came about now.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't want to make the decision.
Didn't want to get the buy-in.
That's right. That's exactly right.
So do you have any other questions about that component of the bill? Okay, the other component of the bill is largely due to changes to the working family. It's now called the Working Family Child Care Credit that came out of the 2015 session that was applicable to the 2016 tax year. And as you know, every time we adopt something new, there's technical issues with it that we discover once we actually put it into practice. And so most of the remainder of the changes here, but one, I think, is a policy change. Most of these are clarifying changes. So on page 2 of the Senate Bill, Senate Bill 162, lines 16 through 18, that is to clarify that Section 129 is a cafeteria plan, and people can put up to $5,000 pre-tax money into their plan to pay for child care expenses. So they're already not paying tax on that income. It's excluded from gross income. So the IRC requires a reduction in the otherwise eligible expenses that they pay. So they can't use it to also claim the tax credit. So if you have, for example, $10,000 of qualifying child care expenses, you put $5,000 of that into your cafeteria plan, then you have to reduce it by $5,000, and the only expenses you can claim on the federal return for the child and dependent care credit is $5,000. So they're not double dipping. When we drafted this, the committee that put this bill forward, the new credit, Working Family Household Independent Care Credit, did not want to tie to the caps that were provided in the federal Child Care and Dependent Care Credit. It was $3,000 and $6,000, and instead provided caps of $12,000 and $24,000. And in doing so, we also inadvertently disconnected from the double dipping prohibition, and we realized that as we were coming through. So we wanted to make sure that you were aware that that was out there, and this would then fix that if you did not intend them to take the benefit twice.
Senator Burchard.
You know, historically, I know when accountants do your taxes, you got to do your federal taxes before you do your state taxes. Mm-hmm. But now it's sounding like you need to lay them down side by side and do them at the same time. Is that a good analysis? Because you're kind of going back and forth now.
Mr. Chair, Senator Bartsugar, I don't know that that's actually true. We still do need to start with the federal return and calculate the federal return, but we do modify it in a number of places. I can just say thank goodness for electronic filing and software, because it does most of that work for us now.
Well, if we reduce it to where you can only deduct five, like the child care scenario, mm-hmm. now you got to go back from your state taxes back to your federal and maybe change it on the federal side. You see what I mean? You kind of have to both of them at the same time.
Yeah, it's definitely a calculation that you have to. There's different outcomes based on the expense cap in each of the two scenarios. Do you have any other questions about that component?
Senator Boquist?
Is there any, and it's probably too early because this is the Kenny Geyer plant, so this is really mm-hmm. a little early, but is there any anecdotal evidence of people double dipping or the cost of that, or have we?
Mr. Chair and Senator Boquist, we actually, people are just now starting to file returns right. claiming this credit. It's for tax year 2016, so we don't have, I mean, we've got a few returns processed, but we don't have data yet,
okay.
which just is something that is unusual, and we've talked with folks that have told us that that wasn't the intent, so we thought we would make sure that you were aware of it. The next piece is on line 26. Of page line 25 and 26, page 2. It changes the date. The credit is calculated based on the percentages chosen based on the age of the youngest child at the close of the tax year under current law. So on December 31st, the issue comes in when we have, when we're looking at the column that says it, in lines, I think it's line 30 down to the bottom of the page where it says at least 6 years old, but less than 13. So in a year that a child turns 13, under the way the statute is currently drafted, those expenses are not allowed on the Oregon return, but those expenses are allowed on the federal return. And so moving it to the start of the tax year by changing the date from the end of the tax year to the first day of the tax year, it allows for those expenses the year that the child is 12 all the way through that calendar year and aligns to federal law.
Right.
Okay. That was something we didn't, you know, in the drafting, we just didn't catch until we started actually implementing it. The next piece is on page 3, and it's, I'm going to skip the line 23 because I believe that's a policy question. I'll come back to that. The changes on line 24 and 25 have to do with taxpayers who do not report earned income in Oregon, usually non-residents. We have some examples of folks who have perhaps rental income that they have to report to Oregon, and they're eligible to claim this credit because they do have earned income, but it's just not taxed here in Oregon. The prior version of the credit, the working family credit that expired with tax year 2015, did have that prohibition. It said you have to have earned income here in Oregon in order to qualify for that. So that is just saying that the person who doesn't have earned income can't claim, that's taxable here in Oregon, can't claim the credit. We think that that's what the intent was, because the idea was that the two credits were merged into one, and I think that was just an omission. Do you have any questions on anything on so far? Okay. So the last piece is on line 23, and I do think this is a policy choice for you. It's not an administrative issue, but we were alerted to it because of we just can see this happening on returns, and we've seen it on the other returns as well. A taxpayer can claim a net operating loss. A net operating loss is a business loss that's incurred in 1 year that exceeds the income from the taxpayer in that year. And it can be carried back to a prior year's return and recoup the tax that was paid on that prior year's return. So people, it's varied over years. It's been a 5-year carryback. I think right now it's a 3-year carryback. But people can go back and amend returns and carry back that loss to offset tax that they had paid in a prior year. And when that happens, this loss offsets their earned income and brings them to an AGI level that then qualifies them for this working family credit. And we're not entirely sure that that was the intent of the legislation. A lot of times net operating losses can be a lot of money and can bring very high income taxpayers down into a lower tax bracket. The term capital loss, we're a little concerned about adding that in there. It's fine if it's in there, but I think that you mean it to be a net capital loss, because a taxpayer can claim a capital loss and it can be offset against gains on the Schedule D. And just because they claim a capital loss doesn't mean that necessarily that you intend for them to do that. I think you mean to say net capital loss. But we also wonder if you intend to not allow any losses or just certain losses. The capital loss, net capital loss, is limited to $3,000 every year. It's not really a substantive change to how the calculation of this credit works, where the NOL deduction is. Rental losses are allowed against this. They're not allowed against earned income for federal tax credits. So we would ask that you consider any losses that a taxpayer is entitled to claim that are not considered earned income related losses, if that makes sense. I know that seems kind of complex. Rental income is passive income. It's usually not allowed against earned income in any federal areas. So we would just ask that you consider those things as you're looking through, because they do artificially change the taxpayer's adjusted gross income that the credit is based on. It doesn't include other items of income. It's that are like the exclusions that Chris talked about in the prior hearing. Those kinds of things are not included in this number either. So using AGI as a measuring point includes things that may not be, they're kind of outliers for folks that are low income that you're trying to help. The bulk of the taxpayers that you intend to help are being helped, but there are some outliers that I think the losses are allowing people to claim that we're not sure you intend them to be helped.
So help me walk through this here, because I think I've grasped, but I need to put it in a little visual, you know, in terms of the loss. So what we're really saying, and this is of course targeted at low income individuals, mm-hmm. low income families, mm-hmm. obviously. It's the old Kinney-Geyer plan mm-hmm. that we've kind of modified. What you're really saying here is, and I'm going to run through a scenario here to understand it, is you could, for example, have an individual whose normal wage earnings are $100,000, who would not qualify for any of this under that scenario. However, they may also be a silent, either active or passive partner in an LLC, LLP, or any one of the other structures. That entity may take a loss, and we'll just say hypothetically, they took an operating loss that year of $75,000. That then would go against the AGI, and suddenly the person who had $100,000 of wages and salaries only has $25,000 maybe down at the bottom, and now they qualify for the low income.
Right.
When they actually themselves may or may not have experienced it. Is that correct?
That is, Mr. Chair and Senator Boquist, yes, that's the example that we're trying to express.
Right. So let me go to step two, which then becomes, and get you to explain how, or Chris explain how we might fix this, if that's the intent, and that's what we want to do, is this same exact thing. You could have someone who, you know, was a sole proprietor, right, who paid themselves $100,000, right, supported out of their mm-hmm. deal. Same exact thing. They lost maybe on their schedule
C,
right, or F, we'll say, for example, lost $75,000, right,
mm-hmm.
and they're now back in the deal and they would qualify for it. But in this particular situation, they weren't the large entity they could sustain the loss. They literally had to take the $75,000 out of their pocket, pay themselves, and mm-hmm. come back in and loan mm-hmm. the company money. And they could, in fact, be in a position where we should be helping them. Mm-hmm. So how do we separate those two scenarios?
Mr. Chair, Senator Boquist, under the Internal Revenue Code currently that we tie to for this credit,
mm-hmm.
Income from a business is the losses and income are allowed against, or they're considered earned income, and so they are allowed. The other things that are not allowed under federal law are rental losses. I do believe farm losses are not allowed under IRC 32. I think that's correct. And I also net operating losses. They're not allowed under these. So I think you can be specific in saying which ones are and are not allowed. Schedule C, Schedule E, non-passive. Those are all forms of earned income under the Internal Revenue Code currently.
Help me out, Chris. Same scenario. Try an explanation, too, so that I can get some clarity here.
I think it can get to be tricky. If you have a sole proprietor and you actually have losses in that year,
mm-hmm.
and depending on, because you are netting them out, if I was following your example correctly, so if you have the Schedule C, I'm the sole proprietor and I'm normally earning $100,000 a year, but then I have a bad year and I actually lose $75,000, I'm not sure if we can, I think there's a fine line between specifying that those losses are allowed, but the other losses aren't.
Mr. Chair.
And so as applied to this draft bill here, the question is, what would be the impact? If we pass this?
Mr. Chair and Senator Boquist, the thing that I didn't express here in that example is that the taxpayer has to have earned income in order to have eligible child care expenses. So if they don't have, whether they're self-employed, whether they have wages or they have a loss, if the Schedule C and the wages net to zero or net to a lower amount, they can only claim the amount of expenses that are up to their earned income under federal law. So let's just say they had... in your example, they had $20,000 of expenses, they would be able to take this credit and use all of their expenses because their income still was greater than the amount. Now, if in your example, if they wiped it out completely to zero and they had no wages, no other income, that was their only income, then they would not be able to claim the credit under current law because the earned income cap under federal law. Does that make sense? Does that help? With
yeah, sort of one follow-up question, Ms. Chair.
Sure.
Could you then, in your speak, give us an example, if this bill was implemented, just a real world example of if we implemented this, what would it do in terms of, because we're trying to say in the policy, do we want them to have it or not, and do we want to be able to tuck these lives? So can you give us an example?
The example that I can think of was a person who had a spouse that had a very high income.
Okay.
I think they were maybe a medical practitioner, made a couple hundred thousand dollars a year. They had a spouse that lived, that worked at home, had a live-in nanny, and incurred about $25,000 a year and closer to $30,000 in expenses. With the cap in Oregon, it was only $24,000 that was allowed to be considered. And her loss actually offset almost all of his income to the point that they got this substantial tax credit. So I think that in that particular case, that was allowed because there was still enough income to claim this. Now, if it had been rental income or rental loss, excuse me, it wouldn't have been allowed. And those numbers are easy to tell on the tax return. They're reported on different lines mm-hmm. and on different schedules. Does that help? Or is it just
clear as mud, yeah.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
The problem is there's winners and losers.
There are. And we think that these are the outliers. We think the bill, as drafted, is getting, you know, most of the bulk of the people that you intend to get to provide assistance to.
Mm.
But there's those outliers out there that are claiming these, like in particular, net operating loss deductions, where they come back years later and amend and qualify when they didn't need it in the first year in the first place.
Right.
That's the biggest one.
I was just wondering, so you can take the whole loss all in one lump sum in 1 year, or do you have to spread it out and only take a certain percentage each year? I mean, isn't there some restrictions on that?
Mr. Chair and Senator Taylor, there are not restrictions. The restriction is up to your income. If you have enough income, you can take that amount, and then it creates a net operating loss if it's from business sources. So, and there's carryback provisions and carry forward provisions. And Chris, I think it's what, 3 and 20 right now, or 3 and 15? So 3 years back, and then they can carry a net operating loss forward 20 years. So if they're substantial, then it can change their financial situation. And a lot of the deductions are, you know, depreciation, business expenses, that kind of thing, that contribute to the NOL, that create the NOL. So there's a couple other, if you don't have any more questions about that particular provision, there's a couple other things that we wanted to just make sure you're aware of. I talked a little bit about the fact that you have to reduce your earned income by the you have to reduce your credit by the amount of earned income. It's capped by your earned income. And so because of non-resident returns, we have federal income and then we also have Oregon income. We just would like some clarity on we think it should be the Oregon, what's in the Oregon column of the Oregon return. And that's not addressed in the bill. So we would see that we would like those just for clarity to be limited to what's provided on the Oregon column, not the federal amount, because again, non-resident may have income that's reported to the feds that's part of the base, but is not subject to taxation here in Oregon because it wasn't earned here, although it is earned income. Like think of a person who lives in maybe Washington and has rental income here in Oregon and works in Seattle. They're not going to report the income that they earn in Seattle to Oregon, only the Oregon source rental income. And so while they do have earned income, it would be confusing for them to cap it on a federal amount when it's not even taxable here in Oregon. So that's one component. Another component is under the Internal Revenue Code, Section 21. Married taxpayers can qualify for a tax credit while one person is attending school or disabled, but a non-married taxpayer cannot do the same thing. They have to be working. And so we just wanted to point that out to you to see if you wanted to treat single individuals or non-married individuals in the same way that you treat married individuals. And then finally, we currently under current Oregon law, we do not pay interest on refunds attributable to the earned income tax credit. It's just an assistance program that comes through the return that isn't an actual refund of tax paid And so the legislature took the position that they shouldn't pay interest on that because it wasn't paid in by them. They didn't have loss of the use of the money, which is a common theme for why interest is paid to people. This same theory applies to the Working Family Child Care Credit. Working Family Household Independent Care Credit, excuse me, the new name of it, this session. So we just want to alert you to that. It's also an assistance program. It is not a refund of tax that's been paid into the system. And we just wanted to point out that those are two programs. They're similar programs, but they're inconsistent in how we treat that. So we wanted to alert you to that as well.
Run that. Which one?
The Earned Income Tax Credit is not a refund of tax. It's just a refundable credit, and it's an assistance program for folks to encourage folks to return to work.
What does that mean? It's refundable but not a refund of tax?
Well, you pay them. So, okay, let me back up. So when you get wages, a normal taxpayer usually gets wages, and they have withholding taken from their check throughout the year. They make $100,000. They have, let's just say, I'm going to use round numbers because I'm coming up with it off the top of my head, a $10,000 tax liability to Oregon. They had $12,000 withheld during the year. They're going to get a $2,000 refund. But they actually have paid that money to the state, and it's been held by the state. So they actually didn't have use of that $2,000. So if we take too long to pay that refund back, we have 45 days to process a return and get the refund out to people after the due date, then we pay interest on that refund of $2,000. Now, unlike that is different than the Earned Income Tax Credit or the Working Family Child Care Credit, because neither of those credits require a taxpayer to put their own money into the state's possession and then request a refund at a later date. It's a assistance program that you have chosen to give this money to these people to help them with their child care expenses. So they have not had the loss of the use of the money. We haven't had possession of that money. So the policy choice you made with the Earned Income Tax Credit was that refunds were not going to have interest paid on them. This is a very similar program, and we do pay interest on these refunds under current law. So I just wanted to point out the inconsistency and let you know so you have a choice on what you want to do.
What is the rate of interest?
The rate of interest, Mr. Chair, changes, and it can change annually. I think right now it's 5%, Chris, I think. It had been, I think we just changed it from 4%. It is the same for deficiencies and delinquencies as it is for refunds, and it's based on federal interest rates. It's 1 point higher than whatever the federal rate is as of the third quarter of the year, and I believe it is just 1 point right now.
Senator Riley, did you have a
question? So those two things are called refunds, but they're not refunds. They're gifts.
Mr. Chair, Senator Riley, I don't know that I would characterize them as gifts, but they're assistance programs that the state, it's a policy choice the state made to provide assistance to these folks for.
So it's money that they didn't put into the system. It's not money that they put in. It's money the state is putting in for them.
Yes. Correct, Mr. Chair and Senator Riley, yes.
Okay. And Mr. Chair, having been involved in this, you know, the last time around when we did the 15, I'm not sure anybody, I don't recall any of us, I think everybody assumed we were doing this like the Earned Income Tax Credit.
Yes.
And I don't even remember the thought process even being between both the two committees of saying we're going to pay interest.
No.
Against, I think we were trying to model this after the Earned Income Tax Credit. I mean,
I have the same memory.
Because, I mean, the bottom line is you can get either of these credits back and have not paid anything else in.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if you recall, we even went to the point of, you know, and most people shudder when we say that, saying maybe we should do this refundable quarterly or something if we want to be more like that type of program, which we never got there. But, I mean, that is obviously a technical issue that we did not anticipate, because I think everybody thought from our good staff that we were modeling this after the Earned Income Tax Credit if you recall, Collins, you weren't here, Senator, but we meshed a whole bunch of these together to make this thing. There were a variety of little small increments of this, and we put it into one large one to be better administrated. So the interest issue is something that I don't think we thought of that we probably need to fix.
Senator Taylor?
Thank you. Chair Haas, how much does the interest cost the state? Do you have any sense?
Mr. Chair, Senator Taylor, I do not know that number.
Mm-hmm.
we haven't started issuing any refunds yet on this, and we wouldn't be until at least June, probably June 1st, depending on how long. What is our due date this year? April 18th, I think. It would be 45 days after that before interest would start being paid.
Senator Burchard.
You guys are pretty good at getting these returns back out, so it's probably a small percentage of the returns that you don't process and get back out. Good statement.
Mr. Chair, Senator Haas, I don't know the percentage, but I can tell you that some of these returns do go into manual review because they are large refunds. So sometimes these particular returns do actually take longer than 45 days. If we, perfectly honest with you, because they're large refunds. And so we have internal controls in place that prevent us from just issuing refunds. I think you might remember we've issued some big ones in the past that were erroneous, and so we've got some pretty tight controls on that. And so sometimes it does take a little bit longer to get those through.
Okay. Senator Boquist.
Thank you, Chairman. Not to complicate this, but it is complicated. So if you, when you said large returns, complex, so on and so forth, I do understand that, but the other thing that I see in here is if we're fixing the capital or the loss issue, which mm-hmm. those are the ones that are going to be large, where you have, as you an example, somebody's making $1 million and they have a loss and they get to offset it, and suddenly they get a working family tax credit, if not an earned income tax credit, because mm-hmm. of the way we grow the system. And so they could be, if we fix the net, if we made a policy decision or whatever it is on the loss issue, that's going to have an impact on the interest issue, because if you're not going to allow someone that got $1 million in income not to take it, period, end of subject, then you're not going to have the complex turn. Because the target group here are, frankly, you know, working families that mm-hmm. might have one or two jobs and they're not making very much money. You know, they're under the poverty level and things like that.
Mr. Chair, Senator Boquist, I don't know that I would characterize the returns that Senator Bartsugger was talking about as being complex returns. They are just large refunds. Taxpayers in this group of folks are typically, they don't understand how they qualify, and they don't understand what substantiation means. So sometimes they don't have evidence of expenses. So sometimes that's what we're looking at to see. We're trying to educate, trying to explain. We reach out to providers and to our partners in other state agencies to explain the record keeping requirements. Anything you offer, any credit deduction has to be substantiated. That's federal and state law. And so sometimes when we have these credits can be extremely large for these low-income folks, and that they would have no ability to repay if we were to issue it and then audit at the back end. So we do tend to look at those kind of things up front just to make sure that they really, you know, we look at it year over year and see, did they claim it last year? Have we already looked at this kind of thing? Is it in line with what our expectations are? But if it's new, if it's big, it could take a while to look at it. Now, the net operating loss ones, I think, are outliers, but I don't know that they would contribute. All of it interplays with the interest calculation, but I don't know how big of a contributor that component is, because I think it's an outlier.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Boquist.
You're going to have to clarify to me large, because we're talking the qualification, unless I'm wrong and I could be, is like 300% of poverty level. So, mm-hmm. I mean, even if they took the maximum deduction for single out, we're not talking like they paid a ton of money into this. What do you mean? Define large return.
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Boquist, I'm talking about a refund, a large refund. And I think, and Chris can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think the highest percentage that we pay of expenses is, I want to say, 75%, and the maximum cap is $24,000. So 75% of $24,000 is $18,000? That is the size of a refund that could come out of this program for one taxpayer. So if they have proof of those expenses, if the refund is, you know, if they fit exactly in the place where their kids are the right age and their income is the right level, they can have those expenses. And we do see that happen. People do have, you know, gifts from family members. It's a $14,000 gift limit every year. And when you start adding that up and multiple family members, we do see some of that situation. But it can be a large credit. So we want to make sure that it's getting out to folks that properly, because the ability for them to repay that if they claimed it erroneously is, if their income really is that low, is next to none. So we don't want to put them in a hardship situation on the back end.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Boquist?
I would like to ask you to come visit me because, I mean,
happy to do
you've
that.
Opened Pandora's box here because I'm wrong, and it's not 300% of poverty, it's 110% of poverty level. And so going upward, so if we have someone that's at 300% or between 100 and 300% of poverty, the maximum, even to qualify their maximum income. So if they're spending $24,000 on this on their tax return, the question is where they get the $24,000 because their income isn't even close.
Mr. Chair, Senator Boquist, I'd be happy to meet with you
and
talk about
hence
that.
We might have a problem in Houston here with the program itself if we have people doing that.
They are outliers, Mr. Chair and Senator Boquist. Those situations are outliers. The bulk of the taxpayers that you're intending to get, you are getting.
Right. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
So the last thing, I almost forgot to cover this. It's on page 3, line 30. It's deleting the phrase, the director of the Department of Revenue. There's a penalty for unlawfully claiming the credit or unlawfully assisting someone in preparing it. And we don't really think that you mean to actually have our director, Ray, actually assess that penalty on people, but instead our staff through procedures. We have a particular statute, and I don't know if this is unique to other agencies, but it does require us, any duty that's assigned to the director is assigned, has to be delegated officially through the Secretary of State's office. And we just don't think that this is a task that it's a kind of a routine task. We didn't think that you actually intended her to do that. There are some things in the statute that does make sense. There's some supervisory orders and appeals and some doubtful liability appeals that she does personally, but generally not this kind of level of work. So that's the final change in the bill that we technical thought you would be interested in.
Okay. So it sounds like this bill is good to go.
Sounds like Chris has a lot of work to do here.
Yeah. No one else here to testify on this bill. We'll close this public hearing for now and revisit it down the road with some amendments.
Thanks.
I'd like to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 171. Chris?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this is one of the tax credit bills. I referenced it there. This pertains to the fire insurance tax credit. The bill, as drafted, just extends the removes the sunset date from January 1, 2018 to January 1, 2024. What this is that insurers who pay the fire insurance premium tax, the amount that they pay for that is a tax credit against the corporate excise tax. And yeah, so that's the nature, that's as simple as the credit is. The revenue impact or the cost to the reduction in the corporate excise tax is about $4 million a year. But this interacts with the retaliatory tax. So roughly speaking, if you decrease the corporate excise tax, you increase the retaliatory tax. They move in opposite directions. So while this costs about $4 million in corporate excise taxes, it actually increases the retaliatory tax by about $2.5 million. So the net impact there is about $1 million to $1.5 million. So said another way, if you were to eliminate the tax credit, you could increase the corporate excise tax by $4 million a year, but you would reduce the retaliatory tax by about $2.5 million a year. So the net impact is in the $1 million range, $1 million to $1.5 million.
Question. Senator Berchiger?
Chris, I'm searching my brain for the definition of fire insurance premium tax. What is that definition?
I don't know. You do. There, the insurance companies are in the room. That might be a good question for them.
Okay.
I don't have a sign-up sheet here, but I do have John Powell in my lineup vision.
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is John Powell. Our firm represents three property casualty insurers affected by this tax credit: State Farm Insurance Companies, Liberty Mutual Insurance Companies, and the American International Group. To Senator Bart Sugar's question, the tax in ORS 731-820 starts out this way. Mr. Chairman, if I just may read the first line of it. I probably should be able to see it if I'm going to read it. It says, and I quote, "For the purpose of maintaining the office of State Fire Marshal and paying the expenses incident thereto, every insurer transacting insurance covering the peril of fire shall pay a tax to the director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services on or before April 1st of each year equal to 1.15% of the gross amount of premiums." And it's a little bit complicated in that there are coverages that include fire but also include other perils such as liability insurance and your homeowners. So if you just go buy a straight fire insurance policy on a building, then the insurance company that sells that pays 1.5% of the premium they collect on that in that annual tax. On your homeowner's policy, they pay on 65% of the premium because there's so many, you're paying for perils of theft and those sorts of things in addition to fire. Commercial multi-peril is 50%. Inland marine, like watercraft, is 20% of that premium is taxed as fire insurance. Automobile physical damage is 8%, and aircraft coverages are 8%. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, this tax and the credit, I think, are due because it basically is for the purpose of funding a state agency. And I think the last time this was up for renewal, the fire insurance premium tax paid about 65% of the total budget of the fire marshal's office. So, and the fire marshal's office does more than just protect property that might be insured. I mean, the responsibility of the fire marshal go statewide into many, many areas beyond just protecting dwellings and that sort of thing. But they do good work in arson detection and those sorts of things, which directly affect insurance and insurance premiums. But because of the broader nature of the services provided by that agency, including part of it going to the training agency to train firefighters and that sort of thing, the wisdom of the legislature in the past has been that this tax should be a credit, and we hope the legislature agrees to continue. It's not a huge item in the budget because of the retaliatory tax that's been explained to you, how that interacts, which reduces the impact. So it's a relatively small credit, but important. Other states do this same thing, but in many, many different ways. And we're still in the process of researching how many states have, quote, credits connected to this type of service that's applied.
Yeah, question. Senator Burchard.
No,
Senator Riley.
Thank you. I'm always interested in the but-for question. And I understand that, you know, the insurance company is doing this to pay for a state agency or to help pay for a state agency. That happens in almost every industry we have in some way or another, usually in fees. And why is this different? Why do we give this credit for something for an industry to pay for services in a state agency? Because that's so. If we didn't do this, would that mean nobody would do fire insurance?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Riley. No, I don't think it means that the system would fall apart. I think it comes with historically a partnership with this agency and insurers paying a fee, unlike a lot of your tax credits that for example, if you hire a certain number of people at a certain wage, you get a tax credit. That affects both the worker that's been hired and the company who hires them. It's a very contained tax credit. In this case, you're funding an agency whose responsibilities are much broader than a direct financial impact to the insurance industry. And its major thrust is prevention and saving lives. I mean, that's the number one goal of that agency. So it's broader than just the direct effect on the payer of it. Usually a fee, and the technical definition of a fee is that the fee has to have a direct relationship to the service being provided. So there usually is, in order for it not to be a tax.
Yeah.
Other fees that the insurance industry pays is they completely fund the insurance division through assessments.
Right. Follow up. So those preventative measures that the department does certainly help your agencies. Even though they're not direct, they keep you from having to pay out a lot of money.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Riley, if they prevent a fire, mm-hmm. yes, that's true.
And that's their goal.
Yes, that's the goal of the agency overall.
Thank you.
And I might also add that because of the working relationship between this agency and insurers, this is a credit that the governor's office has recommended keeping. Mm-hmm. I want to make sure that.
Senator Boquist.
I think it's kind of a question of Chris, because I now remember this thing. I mean, somewhere back before we were all born and people were writing the tax cards, and probably before John was here, this could have been structured into a business deduction, but for whatever reason, states have always chosen to do this as a credit versus sort of a deduction, right? And I think it has to do with this whole complex bloody formula out here that's all changing.
Already a deduction.
Right?
I believe that's the case. The history isn't entirely clear. I mean, it was established in 1609, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So why they chose this path as another path, I'm not crystal clear.
Journey through the day.
That sounds about right.
Thank you.
Other questions?
Okay. Thank you, John. We were going to close the public hearing at Senate Bill 162. We're at the appointed hour, and with no other business before us right now, we will adjourn.
So when was your
business before us right now, we will adjourn.